Hey, hey, and happy new year. Welcome back to the Shit You Don't Learn in School podcast. This is Calvin Rosser.
And this is Steph Smith.
And today we are going to be talking about all the shit that we learned in 2021.
Okay, so in this episode, we're talking about all the shit we learned in 2021. 2021, just like most other years, was 365 days. That's a lot of days where Cal and I, just like all of you, we experimented, we tried new things, we made a bunch of mistakes, and this episode is a compilation of hopefully mostly bests, but also some worse, so that when we move into 2022, if you're listening, you can learn from our bests and hopefully avoid our worst.
Well, I'm glad to hear you experimented because I did a lot of Netflix and chill in 2021, but hopefully there's some good stuff that came out of that.
All right. Well, what we have on deck are, I think, around 10 different categories that we'll go through and we'll just ping pong back and forth. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
All right. So the first category is best new idea. You want to kick us off?
Sure. So everybody knows that income inequality is a big problem. And I think with all things political, there's usually people who fall into different camps, and those camps of what you think should be done are often based on your ideology and what you're told to think. And from my perspective, a lot of the ideas that come out about actually solving problems are just politicized ideas that don't actually solve the problem. But one that I saw last year, I think is deceptively effective and also very simple, is something I call the child wealth grant. And the way it would work is when someone is born, you would give them, say, $5,000, and you would invest that money in the S&P 500, and they couldn't touch that money until some point. That point, maybe they're 21 years old. So in the case of if we gave every child 5K, by the time they were 21, that would be worth like $25,000. And suddenly you, as a 21-year-old, would have 25K. That is huge at that time in your life, especially if you grew up poor or you have debt or anything like that. And maybe you could even incentivize people to keep it longer by adding additional funds if they keep it to a certain point. If we gave every baby in the United States 5K every year, that would only cost us $19 billion a year. And as we've just spent trillions of dollars on different COVID relief programs, and how much of that is actually going to poor people who need it when they need it? How much of that is doing things like this idea would, which is to teach people about ownership and investing, et cetera. I just think that this is an amazingly cheap and pretty simple to execute plan for every baby in the US. And I'd love to see it implemented because there's lots of things that we can do. But in my mind, especially as someone who grew up low income, this would have been a huge help. And I think you could also do things like give more to people who are starting from a lower starting place, whether that's based on income, the number of parents they have in their household, their disabilities, basically things that predict your earning power or that would get in the way of your earning power over time.
Yeah, I think I originally heard this idea on the All In podcast, and I think it checks a lot of the boxes that you said. It teaches people about investing. It teaches people to think in terms of long-term horizons. As we talked about in the billionaire episode, equity is ultimately what drives a lot of wealth in the world. So it would allow people to have an initial go at that, to have an initial equity stake in something as soon as they're born. That's actually really cool. And I think the final thing that you mentioned is this idea of a starting line, which a lot of people talk about. The idea that the starting line is not even today. And I think most people could agree on that in different dimensions. And this helps even out that starting line instead of the finish line. So I think it's a fascinating idea. I've seen a lot of people talk about it in the last year. And if people are listening, I guess I would also be interested to know what the potential downsides of this are, because everyone I've heard talk about it is like, this is genius and it should be implemented.
I haven't heard the politicians talk about it or the people who are actually making these decisions. By the way, one final stat here on this one is for the $5,000 number, that would be just 0.2% of all the tax revenue collected each year. So it's a relatively small amount of tax revenue collected. And I think it's just going back to investing in the future, which is ultimately our children.
Totally.
What was the best idea you encountered in 2021?
So I found this category actually the hardest to answer because there are so many great ideas and it's hard to say one is the best. But one that I found really interesting this year is this idea of asynchronous environments versus synchronous environments. And in particular, I saw a tweet from Jason Calacanis, which used this punchy framework, which is room, zoom, loom, which basically is isolating the habitual versus what is often more effective, or at least that's the way I interpret it. So people often gravitate towards meeting in a room. That's what they're used to, meeting in person. And then the thing that they'll move to next is Zoom. So that is online, but synchronous. And then the final iteration of that is Loom. So it's an asynchronous way of communicating with people. So Room tends to be most habitual, and then Zoom, then Loom. But often from my perspective, the most effective is the other direction, Loom, Zoom, Room. And I thought that was just a cool little punchy framework to think about how we've changed over time, how people are migrating more from meeting in the room to interacting with Zoom and then Loom.
And Loom, for anyone who doesn't know, is just a screen recording software where you can basically record a video of yourself and send it to someone.
Yeah. And I think one quick other point here is it's not just for meetings. So another idea behind this async versus sync environment is audio. We currently are recording this. And so me and you are synchronous, but anyone listening to us is listening asynchronously. So they're listening sometime in the future. And you can think about these ideas with some of the apps that have come out. So for example, Clubhouse, I think, is dying down now for this reason that synchronous environments are habitual. So at the beginning, a lot of people showed up. They're like, oh, this is so cool. I can be here at the same time as someone else. But I think what they ultimately found, or at least what I found, was that showing up synchronously meant that people are less prepared. They haven't really thought about something beforehand. And basically, you as the listener, you are acting as the filter to, you know, get through all the junk. Instead, when it's asynchronous, someone has to show up prepared and think about what they're presenting. It's kind of similar to Amazon asking people to write memos before a meeting, so that even though it's harder for the creator of the asynchronous environment, it's better for the participant.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're here synchronously. This is actually a projection of me. My real body is sleeping. I totally agree with you on the Loom, Zoom, Room point. And specifically, a few years ago, I think people might have thought it was weird at the time, but they enjoyed it. I started recording myself and sending videos on Slack in a work context whenever I needed to potentially ask someone to do something or write a very long wall of text. I found that getting your message across in a long wall of text took forever and it wasn't that effective. And so I would record a video and people really enjoyed that. I could also really think before that video what I was going to say, and then they could watch it on their own terms. And that has proven to be a much more effective way to communicate over time in the workplace. And I see a lot more people doing it now.
All right, let's move on to the next category, which is best new skill.
I can kick it off. So this one, a few years ago, I quit my job to become a full-time creator. And within 6 or 7 months, I actually went back to the workforce. And part of it was because I entered a scarcity mindset as it related to money. Basically, I had no money coming in and I didn't see my trajectory as having money come in. And even though I had some runway, I just totally broke down mentally from that perspective. And that led to low creativity. And I basically was unhappy. And so I had to go back to the workforce. I made a similar move about 8 months ago. And it was the same thing where I was going off on a path where I wasn't sure how I was going to make money, et cetera. Slightly better off than I was the first time, but not that much better off. And throughout this whole time, I've actually mostly maintained an abundance mindset with money. And that means that, you know, I'm still going out to dinners with friends. I'm still being generous with people. I'm still being the person that I want to be. And I'm making decisions as if my future self will somehow unlock a way in this new uncertain path of making sure that I can pay the bills and live the happy life that I want to. There's a lot of things that went into that skill, but it was one of the biggest risk factors that I had in my mind when leaving my job. And so far, I've been really good with that. And I think it will always remain a risk factor for me. But that one was a big win on that front.
I think that's really cool because a lot of the time, people think of skills as like hard technical skills. And I think one of the best skills that you can adopt is reining in your own psychology.
Especially in a path where you need to be creative and in an abundant mindset. And that's just something I learned the first time. I think I probably couldn't have gotten here without going through that first cycle though.
Cool. So my skill was a hard skill and it was learning automation. Now I am still at the very entry level of being able to automate things, but both through no code tools this year and taking an automation course, if people are curious, it was called Automate the Boring Stuff and it taught Python. Just getting into automation makes me so excited about all the things that I can now leverage and hopefully in the future leverage as I learn more. It's crazy to think that if you can learn automation, you're basically duplicating yourself in many ways and you don't even have to hire someone to do that. You just have these robots on your side. I just find that fascinating. And I think the little bit that I've dove into it has just made me really excited to continue learning more. And it also relates to something that we've talked about before where certain skills just set you up to be really highly sought out in the workforce. And I think there's going to be a bunch of automation officers in the workplace in the next 5 to 10 years. And so even though I'm just at the beginning of learning this, it's something that I'm really excited about.
That's awesome. I have a bunch of annoying tasks that I need automated, so I'll send them your way.
Sounds good.
All right. Our next category is best new life hack. Do you want to kick this one off?
Yeah. So mine is really simple, but it was just saying no to all contract work. And you could also extrapolate this to setting rules in your life. We talked about that in doing time right. But I just set a rule around a year ago, which was absolutely no contract work. And I didn't even do that much contract work before that. But just having that rule in my life made it so easy to just say no to everything. And in particular with this, I have not missed it at all. Sure, I maybe could have made a little more money, but I would have been a lot more stressed and unable to focus on a lot of the projects that I've built over the last year.
That's awesome. And I think we talked about it in the How to Say No episode, but one of the things that you've struggled with just in life is saying no to things. So it sounds like that rule-based decision-making works.
Yeah, exactly. How about you? What's your life hack?
So a big focus for me this year was just improving my health. And I discovered a number of things, but I think the most valuable one, which I have also talked about before, is first thing in the morning, I walk outside before even looking at my phone and I get sunlight. And usually I walk to the beach, which for me is a 5 to 7 minute walk or something like that. And so I get about 15 minutes outside. It can be a little bit cold. It can be warm. We're in San Diego, so the temperature doesn't actually change that much. But just that first step of getting outside and jumpstarting my circadian rhythm, it means my body is less sore, I'm more energized, and I'm less groggy. And ultimately, it just starts my day better. It's free. And I can't recommend it enough. If you can, just walk outside first thing in the morning or as soon as you can. It's been game changing for me.
Yeah, I feel like it's crazy because people go and try to find all these really crazy life hacks. And after listening to the Huberman Lab podcast, getting outside in that first phase of the day sounds like the most important thing you can do, which is insane because it's so simple. And I'm like, why didn't we learn that in grade 2 when we were growing up? But yeah, you seem to really have benefited from this. And because I've seen the success of this for you, I have maybe a silly goal for this year, but it's to get outside every day, which I posted on Twitter and someone was like, you don't get outside every day? And I was like, no, I actually don't. So I'm going to try to do that this year.
Did you get outside today?
Not yet, but the day's not over.
That's true.
All right. So next category is best new experience.
Want me to go?
I think we might have the same one, but why don't you start?
Oh, I didn't get a sneak peek at your answers beforehand, but I would say going to Alaska. So earlier this year, actually after I left my job, one of the goals was to find ways to make passive income. And you and I created the Doing Time Right course. If you're interested, you can find it at doingtimeright.com. But after that course, I was, you know, trying to apply the principles of what we were telling people to do. And I was personally a little bit burned out. We created a 60,000 plus word course in a matter of 3 weeks. And
plus a bunch of videos. It was, I think, the most exhausting period of that year.
Yeah, it was super exhausting, but ultimately successful. Anyways, planned a 2-week trip to Alaska and spent the first week with you just completely off the grid. We did tons of cool activities, canoeing, ATVing, etc. And at the end of that first week, we ended up getting engaged on a really badass hike. And so,
wait, what?
Yeah, don't you remember?
Yeah, I'm just kidding.
So I thought that was an awesome way to spend some of the money that we ultimately made from the course in life-enhancing ways, and then also recharge in what ended up being one of the coolest places that I've been. And it was just so action-packed. And I thought that was something I don't usually do when I finish a project or achieve a goal, is to celebrate and to really reward myself. I just keep moving the goalpost. And this was an example of saying, you know what? Who cares if you invest all your profits into this thing? It was totally worth it for me.
Yeah, I really like the point about celebrating. When I got a promotion earlier this year, my boss reminded me of that. So he congratulated me. He said, woohoo, you got your promotion. And then at the end of that call, he was like, what are you going to do to celebrate? And I was like, I don't know, maybe get some carrot cake and celebrate with Cal later today. And he's like, no, you should celebrate. You should go do something exciting, because he was like, you're probably like me where you're always extending that goalpost. And you need to just stop for a second and acknowledge at least what you've accomplished, because you don't want to just wake up the next morning and be on that treadmill of what's next.
It's hard, but it's worth it.
Totally. So mine was similar. It was getting engaged, but maybe not for the same reasons. I think it was an awesome experience going to Alaska and then, of course, having that life moment. But I think also something that you're very aware of is it really challenged me in ways that maybe people aren't aware of in the public, in that I had a little bit of an identity crisis, in so much that for the last several years, I was nomadic and in some ways, really rebelling against many of the things that society ingrains in you, right? Like the typical path of going to a specific school, then doing a specific kind of job, living in a specific place, getting married, etc. And we actually talk about many of these things on the traditions episode, but getting engaged, I think one took me by surprise, but also challenged me in some of those ways where I was like, wait, am I just following the traditional path, which is something that I typically rebel against? And ultimately, I came back kind of full circle and was like, no, I actually really want to do this. I'm really excited. But I think it almost helped me think through why I was challenging other things in my life as well. And so, I don't know, it was an experience for me more so than just getting engaged and telling people and saying, hey, look, I have a ring. But also working through that was interesting for me, but I think a really net positive experience.
I love that you shared that. I feel like a lot of people probably have a similar experience to you in this domain and then in so many other domains, but it's a little bit taboo to talk about some of this stuff because, you know, you should absolutely say yes and you should be so excited. And the ultimate reality is that with so many experiences in life, and I imagine this is true with having children as well, having children isn't all just this amazing thing where there's all this boundless love hanging out all the time. No, it's probably really extremely hard at times and you get very frustrated and maybe you want to give up and all these things. And I wish more people talked about that stuff openly.
Yeah, I think when I originally was working through that, it was very confusing because I was very excited in certain ways, but I also had this looming feeling of, wait, shouldn't I be feeling this way about X? Because that's how you're supposed to feel when, you know, this moment happens or even after this moment happens. And there was elements where I was following that, where I was feeling a lot of those emotions that you're supposed to feel, but then there were some that were missing and then there was new ones. And I just remember Googling a lot of this stuff and surprise, surprise, other people had Googled a lot of the same things. And there was articles where women and probably men as well were saying, yeah, I feel like I'm supposed to feel a certain way. And now I'm analyzing the fact that I'm not feeling this way. And then I was overanalyzing that. But to your point, I think a lot of the time we follow these narratives of how we're supposed to react, especially in big life moments. And it's important to just remember that there is no prescription for how you're supposed to act in those moments. And Google reassures us all that if you Google these things, there are many other people who feel very similarly.
Thank you, Google.
There's actually a good book on that topic, Everybody Lies, which is all about the fact that Google is like everyone's personal therapist that they go to and share all the things that they probably wouldn't even share with a therapist because Google's a machine and they can type anything from like, am I gay, to really terrible things that they think about people. And it's a fascinating book because everybody does lie, but people don't really lie to Google. You know, what's funny about getting married is people say that you should have no secrets with your spouse, and that would actually be a hilarious new age tradition where instead of giving each other vows, you actually gave each other your Google search results from the last year.
I think we'd see marriage is go to zero.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. So the next one kicks off our best worst series. So this one will be our best and worst purchase of the year.
Okay, so this one has a couple runner-ups, which are going back to the co-working space and these Gorilla mats that we got, which make it really easy to work out. But my number one is the e-bike that I got a month or two ago. If people don't know this already, I cannot drive. That is on my goals for this year, so hopefully I will learn. But I can't drive, not because I got in trouble or anything. I just never learned, and I'm now 28. So it's a little embarrassing. But because I can't drive, we live in a town in California, and it's really hard to get around. Most other places I lived when I was nomadic, I could either ride a scooter or use public transit or something like that. And it's been really hard. It's shown me how important mobility is. it's kind of felt like I've lost a bit of my freedom while I'm here. And the e-bike on the way to learning to drive has been so game changing. And then even remove yourself from my situation in terms of not being able to drive, this thing just makes things so convenient. And I think there's some stat that I saw a couple months ago, which was that most car trips, like 90% plus, are within a couple miles. For most things, you really don't need a car. And I love just how convenient the bike is. You also get a little bit of exercise. I'd say similar to a scooter, it's a little fun too. And so for the amount of money that it costs, I think my e-bike costed around $1,000. It is so worth it.
Wow. It seems like you should be an e-bike marketer.
Yeah. I have a 50% stake in the company, you know? So I didn't really have a worst. I guess I would just say everything else. I know that sounds crazy, but it's more so that we've been living in California. We have somehow accumulated so much stuff. And I know that's mostly because of me. I have a shopping problem when I have a house, but most of it doesn't really bring that much value. So I'm sure it's not everything else, but the idea is that there have just been a couple products that really have been game changing. And then the rest I could throw out or give away tomorrow and probably be just as happy. All right. What was your best and worst purchase?
I think as my best one, I have the Oura Ring, which technically might have gotten before 2021, but started using it. And it's a sleep tracker. And so it tells you things like your heart rate, how much you slept, the stages of sleep, etc. And getting good sleep was just from the beginning of the year, one of my top priorities. And it really helped me in so many different ways to know when my body wasn't well rested, when I was well rested. That helped me plan my days. And it also relieved my anxiety on nights where I didn't sleep very well, because more often than not, I actually slept more than I felt like I did. And that gave me some sort of comfort, or at least a baseline of where I actually was. And so for me, that's been really helpful. And I think for some people, it might cause anxiety or something, but that didn't prove to be the case. And I would just tack on to that as maybe runner up, but all the things I did to invest in personal health, an at-home gym, a massage chair, supplements.
Someone's been listening too much to Huberman Lab.
Yeah, I got an addiction to the Huberman Lab podcast too, but basically just it feels good to invest in yourself. And that would flow through to things like surfboards as well, where surfing is a great form of exercise for me that makes me happy. And I have nothing but joy for the money that I've spent in that domain. On the worst purchases, I did a lot of active trading last year, and I would say the things that made me least happy on that front were options. So call and put options. They're just speculative gambles if you don't know what you're doing. I ended up losing some money, not too much, but ultimately it just made me unhappy. It made me on edge on certain days, which reduced the quality of my time with my work or the people around me or even myself, and sometimes disturb my sleep. And that just, it totally wasn't worth it. Even if I had cashed in big, still wouldn't have been worth it. And now just have a blanket rule not to trade options.
Yeah, that actually leads into our next category, which is best and worst investments. My worst investment was basically the same thing. Now, I'm carrying this over from 2020, which I did this more heavily. But in 2020, I started shorting the market, which, if anyone followed the market, did not work out for me. But more than that, it was for the first time ever for me, I was watching the market. I was checking it when I was waking up. And this kind of carried through into part of 2021. And I would say just overall, that was my worst investment. It wasn't any one investment in particular. It was really just like this hyper awareness of what was going on there. And I like to think of investing time and money as tangential to one another, where yes, you can get more money and maybe that will save you time in the future or vice versa. This was one of those investments where it was like, maybe I might make money, which I didn't even end up doing. But really what it did is it completely zapped my time energy. And so I think what I've done much better in the last, I'd say like 6 to 12 months, is just not follow it at all and invest in things that are a lot more stable and that I just don't have to watch.
Yeah, I guess I'll just tack on there. That's also my worst investment as well, which is basically actively trading in and watching the market. So related to the call and put options, but I entered all kinds of markets. So short-term trades, swing trades, long-term trades, crypto trades, NFTs. I did it all. And I learned a ton along the way, which I'll talk about in my best investment. But ultimately, I found that even if you can make money in this domain, unless you're making like very life-changing money, it can be a massive distraction to what actually sets you up best in the long term or what makes you feel happiest. And at least for me right now, I'm prioritizing, you know, putting my energy into creative domains that, whether they pay off or not, are going to fill my bucket. And this was like one, I'll call it like a time distraction where I went there and maybe I did okay in some ways, but it just was totally not worth the investment of time.
Yeah. And I would also add to that, something I learned is even if I think I am smart in some domains, investing is a domain where you're competing against institutions, you're competing against people who have done this full time for decades. And it's not to say that you can't quote unquote win, or I think we saw a lot of retail investors who did really well in the last year or two. But the point is that there was just so many times where I had a hypothesis and the hypothesis itself was right, but I didn't understand wider market dynamics. So for example, I had a hypothesis that this pandemic would last for years. And look at us, it has lasted for years. But a part that I didn't fully understand is the role of the Fed and how they can drive stimulus and adjust the way that the market responds to something like a crisis. Another example is I really did not fully understand the extent of the Chinese government's control or willingness to step in and change companies within their country. And so I invested in China. That didn't do very well. And so my point is that you hear a bunch of success stories of other people who are doing really well. And ultimately, I think there's a lot of people who are probably similar to me who thought they were really smart in one dimension, but then didn't really know fully what they were doing.
Well, now that we've had our therapy session about markets, which seems like we should both not focus on for too much, what was your best investment of the year?
Yeah, this is cliche, but it was myself, which means that my worst investment was realizing that, look, I really don't know what I'm doing in financial markets. Let me just bet on things that, you know, have proven to do well and to not have to be watched over closely with my money. And then with my time, I'm investing it in things that I'm passionate about. And as a creator, that is something I actually have confidence in. And so that was my best investment over the last year, was my own projects, building them up. And that's also where I plan to allocate my attention in future years. Also, one amazing thing about investing in yourself is you never go negative, as in every investment that you make in yourself builds on top of your previous investment, unlike financial investments, which, as we all know, can have some serious downside.
Ultimately, investing yourself is probably the most reliable thing that you can do, and you can layer on these other things, but that typically is a way to just keep improving and feeling good. And I tend to think it's a good philosophy for life if you're stuck on what you should do. My best investment of the year, I guess you could think of this investment myself, but it was more of a learning area, which was the Web3 space. So I thought of crypto as this kind of bubble, and it had a lot of maximalist religious type of behavior, and that turned me off. But then I found some weird entry points into the world of decentralized finance, and I just followed that thread from, I think, about April through the end of the year. And I ended up discovering just a lot of things that I personally found interesting. I probably, you know, played in each of the different crypto spaces, and I learned in a way that made me less skeptical of, say, the future of this thing, but that also gave me higher conviction and a better eye for opportunities that may be interesting, whether it's future employment opportunities or good investment opportunities. And that was cool to just see that progression and how just playing around and learning with an open mind can unlock a lot of different things. I think one of the biggest lessons I took away from that is I think crypto is doing something very cool as it relates to engaging communities and using modern online marketing to generate user adoption. And it's almost like a new frontier of growth marketing. I don't think people talk about it in that way, but as a growth marketer, like, I know all the classic Web2 tactics of how to acquire traffic and stuff like this, but they're using new techniques that align human incentives in this really beautiful, elegant way. And I think that's part of the reason you see such widespread adoption outside of this speculative frenzy and such. So I found that intellectually interesting. And I also think at its core, that piece of it will be a part of the future.
Yeah, I think you set yourself up really well in this space because you focused on how to learn about it instead of just how do I get rich quick off of this very bubbly ecosystem right now, or at least I think it's very bubbly. You've kind of inspired me to want to learn more about Web3. And that's actually one of my goals this year, learn more about DeFi.
Well, let me know of any questions.
All right. Best and worst trend.
So I'll take this one first. I think the best trend, which I guess I just gave it away accidentally, but I think that Web3 is using community in just a very almost novel way, at least in terms of its ability to get users extremely quickly. And so a good example of this is, I think, the Ethereum name service. You can think of it like a domain register. I bought calvinrusser.com at GoDaddy or wherever I bought it, and you can buy an ENS name. So I can buy like calvin.eth and I can send crypto to that domain, and there's other things that can be done. That product was around for at least a couple of years, and there was maybe a couple hundred thousand users. And what that service did is they took some of the profits from people buying domains and they actually just gave them back to those early users of the community. So it's called an airdrop in crypto. But I ended up waking up one day, and just because I had bought a $30 ENS domain, they airdropped me like $6,000. And so I woke up and in my digital wallet, there's $6,000, and some people had $30,000 or $50,000. And I'm like, damn, I want to be those people. I guess we're all relative, but it was an amazing thing. And it was all because I was just like an early user of this product. And you're seeing this happen across crypto. It's not entirely sustainable, but I think it's actually quite beautiful in its ability to incentivize people who use your product early and who are advocates, who spread the word in financial ways, which is obviously a motivation of humans, and ultimately gets more people to use your product and talk about it. And to me, it's just like marketing spend. As much as it's like a benevolent thing to award early users something, it's also a great way to just continue getting traction for your product. And I think crypto has done different things like that. And it's all about leveraging community to get adoption. I think it's so cool.
Yeah, something I've noticed about the marketing side of things is, to your point, crypto really cuts out the middleman. So there probably was other acquisition tactics before this, but for a long time, in order to acquire users, you use platforms, right? Like Facebook. And what that meant is you are paying Facebook to connect you with the right people that are their users. Another form of that, which eliminated the ad platform, but still had a middleman, was using your existing users to refer other people like them. But that middleman is the person, right? The existing user, where you're paying them to refer someone new. But what a lot of platforms in Web3 and also outside of Web3 are realizing, that they can actually take that money that they would be spending on acquiring users and paying the middlemen and actually just pay the user. Like, you're worth, let's say, $5 to us, we'll pay you $3 of that. And sometimes the economics are even more compelling, where a couple examples of this, like AppSumo, paid creators to launch products on their platform. And I think they actually allocated $1 million. There's all these pay-to-play games like Axie Infinity, which, again, they're eliminating the middle person by saying, we would actually typically pay someone else to attract you, and instead we're paying you to participate in this ecosystem.
Yeah, you're seeing how much money actually goes into growing products and engaging users. And you don't see it right now with other products because it all goes to the Facebooks of the world. But now some of it's going to you, and that some of it for most people is pretty meaningful. The other piece of this that I just find awesome is, I think in a lot of ways, whether it's through like the memes or the excitement about prices or the humor that floats around as people tweet every 1K rise in Bitcoin, and then when it drops 5K, they're just totally silent, is the internet is becoming in some ways fun again. I wasn't around for the first kind of evolution of the internet, but I think in a lot of ways, like, crypto has made the internet fun, especially in a time where a lot of us are locked inside and spending more time on our computers. I can't discount the fact that a lot of the adoption just comes from people needing that sense of connection, or just that light snippet of humor that you'll find on Twitter or wherever that makes you feel just a little bit less lonely.
That's nice. But I think you're right also that the reason that so many crypto projects have done so well, and we'll see if that continues to be true, is the fun element of it. Like, people want to participate because it feels like they're pulling that slot machine, which is why it so quickly can drive so many users towards a project.
And I think one thing that makes me bullish on its continuation is that fun and the technology behind it has attracted a lot of talent and a lot of capital. And it may become a self-fulfilling prophecy because so many people are engaged in it. Eventually, very useful things will come out of it. But let's not talk about crypto forever.
Yeah. And I will just say, not financial advice, which is obvious, but also that something can be the future, but also be overvalued today, as we talked about in the Bubble episode. So just a friendly little reminder from Bear Stuff.
That sounds a lot like financial advice. All right. My worst trend, and this is probably going to continue forever because it's just people, but I think people engaging in zero sum and us versus them thinking. I see whether it's in views about the pandemic or debates about economic issues or people trying to cancel other people or people trying to criticize other people who are just not on their side. This is that us versus them dynamic. There's just a lot of vitriol and I think lack of compassion flowing, especially in the online world. And that has, I think for the first time in my life, I've seen it translate to the in-person world. I've seen it happen in family interactions. I've seen it happen in friendship interactions in ways that it was not happening before. And so a lot of people talk about we're more divided than ever. And I think part of that is true in that it's bled over, probably because we're all stuck at home and trying to figure out how to live our lives in a happy way when we're pretty lonely and isolated as a group of species. And I think at least for me personally, this kind of goes against the ethos with how I like to engage with the world. I'll have a conversation with anyone because I think I can learn something from everyone I meet and I try to approach people with an open mind, ask them questions. I think in that way, you can build that human connection. And so my advice for people is if you found yourself falling in this hole of thinking that there's some evil group of people out there or something like that, maybe get more out in the world and actually talk to people, ask them questions, and remember that we're all in this thing together. Most people are good people. And if you sit them down for a beer, I think you'd find that 99% of what you want is the same as them. You may disagree on a few things, but that doesn't mean you can't be friends. And that's my cheesy rant.
Nice. I wanted to share something related from Visa. His handle is Visa Canv. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. He's one of my favorite followers on Twitter. And I remember this one time he posted something along the lines of, I think people in the K-pop sphere, when people would hate on them on Twitter or say really terrible things to them, instead of getting in fights or instead of ignoring them, they would send these like really hilarious messages back being like, thanks for the feedback, Brosif, or like, you do you, you rock, man. And it was just really funny because instead of meeting people with an angry response back or rebuttal, even though it's really hard, sometimes you're just better off by sending like a friendly message back or ignoring it. But this gets back to your point where I think there's just like a lot of animosity. And sometimes, again, it's hard. It's helpful to be the bigger person and just be like, you know what? I respect you, man. Like, you think whatever you want.
100%. If you've ever been in a conversation with someone who's angry or if you've been angry, is it helpful if the other person meets you with anger? Almost never. And if you can remain calm and patient, the other person almost meets you in that place. And I just can't help but thinking, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately, that a lot of people are just truly lonely. They're isolated. They might be slightly depressed. I think a lot of the things that you see coming out from people that may seem unsettling is just ultimately like a projection of that inner dissatisfaction. And they're looking for someone to blame because they don't want to actually recognize within themselves that they need to change something. And I think it's been hard for a lot of people, especially as you're cooped up at home. Even I had a therapist who told me during the beginning of the pandemic, she's get the hell outside, go to a Starbucks, even if you just go through the drive-thru, interacting with that person who gives you the drink is like an important part of your psychology as like a social animal. And I'm like, oh, that's right. And so I started going outside more. And it truly is helpful to kind of remember that people are people and to go engage with them in real life.
Yeah. I, by the way, found the tweet. It's pretty funny. He's basically, it's a long tweet thread, but he's explaining that the main thing to understand is that when they're trying to wear you down and discourage you, the thing to do in response is to absolutely refuse to be discouraged. But then he gives the example. He says, K-pop stans are a master of this and I respect it. You insult them and they reply, so true, bestie. Anyway, stream, insert favorite artist. And basically, they are relentless about being unbothered by other people hating on them, which, again, really hard to do. But I think it's just a hilarious way to approach some of those situations.
All right. So key takeaway, cut the zero-sum thinking, cut the us versus them thinking, be good to yourself, be good to people.
Okay. So your best trend, Web3, worst trend, zero-sum thinking. My best trend, which I hate to bring up the same topic that I always talk about, but it is the trend that I think is so exciting and really took off in 2021, which is this adoption of remote work and specifically the great resignation that everyone's talking about. The trend that I'm excited about is a big swath of the population is realizing they have agency. They're realizing that what they were told for so many years as essential was never essential. And that many of the things that they were doing and that large companies were adopting were just continuations of things that existed for decades. As we've talked about before, Ford introduced the 40-hour work week in 1914. We are now in 2022, over 100 years later, and many companies are working the same way. And I would just say that in addition to this benefiting the individuals, there are mass changes going on. An example of this is a stat that I stumbled upon the other day, which is about commuting. So with all of these people now working from home, the amount of time saved is insane. So I think I found a study that showed before the pandemic, there was around 5% of people working from home, and now it's around 50%. And if you take that delta and incorporate the number of people who work in America, et cetera, the number of commute hours saved is insane. So within 1 year, 16.3 billion commute hours are saved for just America. That is equivalent to 1.9 million years or 23,000 lifetimes. 23,000 lifetimes in 1 year. Every year is saved from people not commuting and being able to do things that they want to do, getting more sleep, taking care of their kids. This is just one example. This change where people realize they have agency is impacting things like commutes, but I also think will be a trend that continues as people wake up in 2022, 2023, et cetera, where they're like, oh, wait, I actually also don't have to do this.
It sounds like you're a pretty big fan of remote work.
Yes. I just think the scale of this is so exciting. Like billions of hours. That's insane that as a world, we had just accepted that the average commute in the States was 54 minutes. Every single day, people took a non-trivial portion of their awake lives and dedicated it to sitting in a car to get to some arbitrary office 54 minutes away. And they did that every day that they worked.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So that's my best trend. I just think it's really exciting and people should realize that they have agency to make decisions. My worst trend is all of the scammy shit that has happened in the last year. There's always scams. This is not a new thing in 2021, but I do think that there were new vehicles, whether it was through crypto or things like SPACs, which enabled many more people to participate, which is a positive thing. But then anytime something's democratized, it invites just a lot of people with bad incentives or bad motives. And I think it was just a little unfortunate, but again, not necessarily unexpected to see how many just shit coins were produced, how many SPACs are now down like 30 to 50%. Meanwhile, the people who sponsored the SPAC made like tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. So anyway, I think seeing that was a little unfortunate because often it's the retail investor or the less educated investor that holds the bag. But I guess it's a positive in a way where there's all these exciting vehicles, but then my worst trend is seeing people abuse them.
All right. So we have five more categories to go. Why don't we rapid fire through those?
Yeah, a lot of these are quick. The next one is best podcast. For me, it was the All In Pod. A lot of people are familiar with it. The reason I chose this pod is very simple. It is the one pod that I am genuinely excited to listen to when I see it on my feed.
I actually get up in the middle of the night to listen to it.
Yeah, I know. Is that yours as well?
No, mine's the Huberman Lab, which is basically just a Stanford professor who gives a lot of health advice and he goes pretty deep. But that was my main focus area of the year in terms of personal improvement. I learned a ton of things and still haven't digested a lot of the info in the pod, but I actually feel like it's empowered me to understand the mechanisms of health in a way that I've always wanted to. And it happened right at the time when I wanted to do it. He's blown up, the pod's blown up, and I think it's the greatest.
Yeah, and I also think the space is super interesting. He just launched a new pod with David Sinclair, and the work happening in the longevity space is fascinating. So yeah, I think it's certainly up there for me. But as people say, you got to look at what people do, not what they say. And if you look at my listening habits, All In was like, it's out. I'm listening to it in 30 minutes. Huberman Lab, sometimes I found a little heavy to actually listen to.
Very heavy. All right. Who's your best creator of the year?
So this one was hard because there are so many awesome creators. To call out a couple, I really liked this guy, Keegan Hall, who I discovered he does these like pencil drawings that end up looking like true photographs. So that was one cool find this year. I also mentioned Visa. He's one of my favorite Twitter follows. David Friedberg was from the All In Pod. I don't know if people would call him a creator, but he's someone that I really enjoyed learning from. But the one that I chose is this guy named Brian Fogel, who is a director that maybe people would recognize, maybe they wouldn't, but he is the producer of Icarus, which I think a lot of people have heard of, and The Dissident. I originally found him through The Dissident. I was on a plane, just was choosing random movies, happened to stumble upon this one. And both of these are like investigative documentaries. One of them is about Russian doping in the Olympics. The second is about the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, which people probably are familiar with, but both documentaries were fascinating. And the reason I chose him, by the way, neither of these were made in 2021, but I discovered them in 2021, is that he is a creator I really look up to in that he made really difficult decisions. He wasn't chasing money. In fact, I think for Icarus, he had to self-fund a lot of it. But in addition to that, can't go to Russia now. I'm sure he has put himself in danger as well through producing The Dissident. But he made these difficult decisions to get information out there and to, in some way, do the right thing. And so the reason I chose him is because that is the type of creator that I hope to aspire to be over time, as someone who, I guess, sticks to their values and provides value outside of just trying to chase dollar bills. And so, yeah, that was my favorite creator. And I also would just encourage people, if they haven't seen those documentaries, to watch them.
Cool. That's a nice choice.
What's yours?
Mine was this dude, Nat Eliason. He was an agency owner for a long time. He did like SEO and other things to help you build websites. And then he was a blogger, which I'll say just broadly about personal development. And I've been following him for a few years, mostly because some dude in Poland was like, "Hey, are you Nat Eliason?" And I'm like, "What'd you say to me? Who's that?" But anyways, his stuff ended up being pretty interesting, but he made a career shift this year and is now all in on crypto. But what I found really interesting is he shared how he started going from agency owner to something else. And I think he tried a bunch of things, like was going to start a cafe, tried to be a YouTuber, and then ultimately found Web3, which was fascinating for him, and became like a Solidity developer and stuff. And the dude has just been prolific in terms of producing courses and products and sharing his learnings in the space, which has helped me enter the space as well. So maybe I have an affinity because of that. But I think it's a really great example of someone who is pretty successful, but then goes and makes a career pivot in a way where you're just rapidly experimenting. You're just going from thing to thing and you're lost, and maybe you lost your sense of identity along the way. He found something, he sunk his teeth in. He's now, I think, doing extremely well financially from this and just seems to be having a lot of fun and doing it on his terms. And so I think that's in many ways like how I tried to live my life and how I think I am living my life. And I'd love to see more people do that. More people who could get an average job or who could leverage the path that they're on, actually say, "Hey, I'm not fulfilled on this. I'm going to go figure something else out. I don't know what that is, but I'm going to experiment for a year, see where I land from there and go." And I think he's done that in a really cool way. And then because he's a blogger, he's shared it along the way. So I imagine that's helped a lot of people. And I just think that's really cool. I think more people should do that.
Yeah, he's a perfect example of someone who's just followed their curiosities and not gotten stuck. Whereas I feel like some creators, they'll follow their curiosity and then one thing will really hit and then they'll feel the need to just double down on that forever. But what Nat's done, he's like started an agency, he's created several courses, now he's really into some Web3 projects. But yes, I agree. I think it's been really cool to see him constantly reinvent himself, which I don't really see across many creators. Again, I feel like creators will like find something and then they tend to stick with that for a really long time.
Yeah, you just got to learn to bet on yourself and learn how to navigate the muddy waters. And I think he's done a great job.
Cool. All right. Best personal win or accomplishment?
So for me, this actually came late in the year, and I had actually quit my job earlier in the year to write a book. And then in the meantime, I was building passive income streams and I ended up doing some freelance work for a long time. So I didn't really get started on the book. And I've been thinking about writing a book for so long, and I've done a lot of planning and research, and it's just been this, it's my white whale. It's just like this thing I keep chasing, but I can't get after it. And ultimately, like the one thing I had never really done is just sat down and wrote, even though that's the thing that everyone tells you to do. In November, I ended up meeting this guy and he's, hey, do you want to set some goals for the month or something? And I said, yeah, I want to write for 1 hour per day. And if I don't do that, I'm going to pay you $50. And I ended up writing every single day. Like, it turns out that the $50 to this guy that I basically had just recently met was not something that I wanted to give. And I also wanted to make progress. By the end of the month, I had over 20,000 words and I had a lot of momentum and I had a lot more confidence in the project. And I think what I took away from that in terms of why it's my best personal win, one, I made progress on something that I have been talking about forever and I hate hearing myself talk about because I haven't made progress in the ways that I otherwise have. And then the second was to realize that with 1 hour of focused effort every day, you can get so much more traction than your mind tells you. Like, the compounding effect of 1 hour per day is actually pretty incredible. And because I was just writing like 20,000 words going from zero to that was very inspiring for me. And it gave me a high degree of confidence that this year I'll be able to likely finish this thing, which is super important to me.
That's awesome. And if people are not as familiar with like how much is 20,000 words, a typical novel, I think, is around 50,000 words. And so that's a lot of words. A long blog post is a couple thousand words. An average blog post is probably 1,000 words or so. So yeah, that's a lot of progress and that's super exciting. And when I wrote my book, I found the same thing where it wasn't so hard to do it once I was going, but it was just so hard to get started.
What's your best personal win?
So what I came to for this one was starting to angel invest. And it wasn't so much that the angel investing has gone exceptionally well, but it is that I'm actually just really proud of myself for all the work that I did leading up to this to get to a level of financial stability where I can do that. It was a revelation for me this year where I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not making large checks or anything, but I can actually go and invest in these companies. And I think that's so cool. And it's something that I wanted to do for a very long time. So yeah, that was my personal win, is just that I got myself to this place where I can now do this activity, which I actually find really fun, learning about these companies. And now I've put myself in a place where I can actually do it.
That's cool. Angel investing is nice in that you just write the check and then you can't check the price all the time. You might have to wait 10 years to see an outcome. So that's good for psychology like mine.
Yeah. And we talked before about the amazingness of automation, where you're basically taking a bunch of robots and getting them to go and do work for you. I think angel investing, although very risky, is kind of exciting in that way too, where you're basically taking your money and you're deploying it to these really talented people and being like, look, I think you can do more with this money. I think you can build massive companies. Like, that's so exciting. And so I think that's another reason that I personally find this method of investment, even though certainly more risky, more enjoyable for me, where I can see things being built.
All right, we got two more categories. So next one is your number one goal for next year.
Okay, so I have a bunch of goals. I've mentioned some of them. And if people want to see all of them, they can go to my open page, which is stephsmith.io/open, where I've actually shared my goals for, I think, the last 3 or 4 years. My top goal for this year, though, is actually to grow this pod. This is something that I've really enjoyed doing and want to continue doing. We hit 10K listens in December, which is so exciting. And that was actually our goal. And I'm surprised that we hit it right at the last moment. And this year, the goal is to hit 50,000 listens a month.
I think we can do it.
Yeah. So if people want to help me reach my number one goal, go share this podcast with someone.
And leave a review.
All right. So what was your number one goal?
Mine is writing my book. I've been talking about doing it forever. It's broadly speaking about how one goes about ascending in the world. And I already have some words on paper. I think in the first quarter of this year, I'm really focused on getting a first draft of the whole thing. And I'm excited to tell some hard-hitting stories that hopefully inspire people to get more out of their lives. And I'll finally be able to tackle my white whale.
Since you were so driven by the $50, I think what we should do is, if you don't finish this book, you pay me $100,000 by the end of the year.
Well, I might have to take out a loan from you first.
All right. So the final category is prediction of the year, prediction for 2022. You want to start?
Yeah. So I'll start with my positive prediction, which is really my prediction for the year. And I think that the world is going to go back to quote unquote normal this year. I think a lot of people, including myself, feel like there's before 2020 and then there's after 2020. And I'm stunned that 2 years of the pandemic has gone on. I'm like, what did I do in that time? And I certainly actually didn't do as much as I wanted to. And it's been tough in a lot of different ways. I think, though, that between like COVID fatigue, lots of people being vaccinated and boosted, and then this fast spread of Omicron, basically we're going to end up back in a normal state relatively soon, unless something fundamentally changes about like a new variant that's super deadly or something like that. I just, people who are just itching to go back to their lives. And I think more and more people are, and they're willing to take the risk of integrating in a world with a new set of health circumstances. And hopefully governments allow us to do that and such. And I think to the extent that certain places you can't, people are just going to either move out of those places or not go to them. And they're going to navigate to areas where they can feel like they're living a normal life, because I think at the core, that's what everyone wants. And they want to do that in a responsible way. Now, that's my relatively happy, positive prediction. I will say I do have a spooky feeling that there will be some sort of major disruptive event in the world this year or soon to be. That could be a war, a financial meltdown. It could be some sort of breakdown of the fabric of society. And all of that may sound very extreme, but cybersecurity attacks have already taken down power grids. We've already had cases of local grids being taken down and those governments are extorted for Bitcoin. And I think that we're somewhat at risk of that happening on a larger scale in a way where you'd quickly realize that society is actually extremely fragile. There's all these things that work for us on a daily basis that we don't realize, one, how they work, and then two, that may not work. Like, we have isolated events of this. I grew up in a state where there's lots of hurricanes and you'd lose power and you'd be like, wow, I really value power. And so I think we're in a stage where this pandemic has been ravaging the world for a while. We have a more complicated technological infrastructure. We have maybe politicians who are motivated to do something like war to get someone on their side or whatever. That wouldn't be a surprise to me. And then you have really frothy financial markets. And so I think a lot of that puts us at risk of something happening that could be very disruptive and surprising. And that may also be the reason why we're, say, you know, going back to normal away from COVID, because maybe there's something else that captures our attention, which I think almost certainly has to happen before the spotlight moves away from something like COVID.
Yeah, I don't know if I make the same prediction, but I will agree with you on this idea that it always surprises me to consider just how fragile humans are. We were joking about this the other day because I was like choking on something and I was like, wow, I could just choke on a piece of gum and that could take me out. And humans are like incredibly resilient in ways, but then also really fragile. And I think that same mechanic applies to our civilization, where it's like, holy crap, like we're so advanced. We've created technologies that can cure cancer and that can transmit video across the world, yet a large natural disaster could just wipe out a lot of people. So I do agree with you that we are at a really interesting place where people have been living through this pandemic for so long that I think a lot of people, whether they realize it or not, are on edge. And that is compounded by the state of things like the financial markets.
Now that we went down that rabbit hole, why don't we wrap up with your prediction of the year, which hopefully is a positive one.
Yeah, so I kept mine pretty simple. It relates back to my favorite topic, which is about the future of work. But it is this idea that I think 2021, or you could also say 2020, was the year of location independence, which meant that, as we talked about, many people started working from home, but also a lot of people relocated when they realized that they didn't need to be tethered to their workplace. I think this year, or at least the next couple years, will be an extension of that, where instead of just location independence, people will push for schedule independence. People will realize that a lot of meetings are unnecessary and that they get their best work done when they are not synchronously attached to their coworkers. And so I think you're going to see a lot more people discover that or realize it and push for schedule independence, which means that you not only can work from wherever you want, but you can design your own schedule and you can basically allocate your time as needed to get your best work done. So I think that's going to be an interesting trend moving forward in the future of workspace. And then a quick other prediction is just people like you have gotten really into sleep and the focus on your health through that vector. I think there's going to be a wave of sleep influencers over the next couple years, where the same way we have nutrition influencers or fitness influencers that tell you their routines and what they're trying and what the results of those are, I think you're going to have the same thing with sleep influencers.
Every time I share with people how much deep sleep and REM sleep I get every night, they're like, how'd you do that, bro? Maybe I should be a sleep influencer.
Maybe you should. I will say, I think you're half kidding, but when you meet other people, I've seen it, when you start talking about your sleep metrics, you guys get so excited, not just you, but the people you're talking to. And that makes me think, past just the science of it, it's going to be a huge trend, because people just get really animated when they talk about the subject once they're into it. And I think that today it's probably a smaller population, but that will expand to the wider population.
Let's hope so.
All right. It's time for you to put up your sleep open page.
My sleep was not very good last week, so I might wait for a good solid week.
All right. That closes out our shit we learned in 2021 episode. If you learned anything especially interesting last year and you want to share it with us, you can find me at StephSmithIO on Twitter.
And you can find me at Calvin_Rosser on Twitter.
We'd love to hear from you, and we hope that you can learn from some of these experiences or learnings from last year and apply them to your 2022.
Don't trade options, kids.
Thanks for listening.
Until next time.